good to see you all again so soon. Normally we don't get to be back-to-back like this, but we're very excited and blessed to do that. And we're excited for another reason, too, because early this afternoon I got a very exciting email and asking us if we would like to come and work with you all full-time. And we've graciously decided to accept and to come and work with this congregation, this family, I believe starting April 1st. So we are so excited and ready for this. I know so many of you have been praying for that and for this. As open as you could about praying with other things about this opportunity, we are very excited and blessed. We are just ready to come and be a part of this family. We love you and are so very thankful that you've given us the opportunity to come and grow as much as we have been able to, and that you have said you've been able to see us grow and together and see my work and grow as well. So with that all being said, we'll open up to Psalms chapter 12. Psalm chapter 12 is where we'll be spending our time tonight. As we look, in whose words do I trust? In whose words do I trust? This is a short psalm, only 8 verses long, but I think there's some very powerful things to learn out of this psalm. So begin in verse 1. It says, "Help, Lord, for the godly man ceases to be, for the faithful disappearing from among the sons of men. They speak falsehood to one another with flattering lips, and with a double heart they speak. May the Lord cut off all flattering lips, the tongue that speaks great things. Who have said, 'With our tongue we will prevail, our lips are our own'? Who is Lord over us? Because of the devastation of the afflicted, because of the groaning of the needy, now I will arise, says the Lord. I will set him in the safety for which he longs. The words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in a furnace on the earth, refined 7 times. You, O Lord, will keep them. You will preserve him from this generation forever. The wicked strut about on every side when vileness is exalted among the sons of men." Now, we're not really sure when this psalm was written, but I think it feels safe to assume that it was during one of David's dark times, one of those times where he felt really alone. He felt isolated when he would try to reach out for somebody, for something to grab onto. It was no one, nothing there. At least that's how he felt. So for example, or we'll use this for the illustration tonight to go along with this. Imagine, if you will, David's moments in his life after he has saved the nation from Goliath and from the Philistines. You should be familiar with that story. David, the ruddy young man, goes out, sees this incredibly tall man, this being, proclaiming really profanity and injustice against God and against his people. And David stands and says, "Really? Is no one going to stand up for the Lord? Is no one going to stand for his people?" David finally says, "You know what? Fine. I'll do it. I will stand for the Lord because I know he has my back. Because I trust in him as he has done so much for me already." The words reach Saul, and he brings David in to try to arm him for battle. And Saul's armor, obviously, is way too big for this young lad. So he says, "I'm just going to go out as I am, staff and sling, and I'll face the giant." So in 1 Samuel chapter 17, in verse 45, it says, "Then David said to the Philistine, 'You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and to the wild beasts on the earth. that all of the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all of this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hands." And with that, the ruddy young lad sinks a stone deep into the Philistine's forehead, and Goliath falls with a loud, thunderous oomph. And it goes quiet, because David just simply walks over and pick up in verse 50. "Then David prevailed over the Philistine with sling and stone, and he struck him and killed him, and there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran, stood over the Philistine, and took his sword, drew it out of its sheath, and killed him, and cut his head off with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled." He stands victorious. Now he turns and he begins to lead the charging, energetic, now invigorated army of Israel, chasing after the Philistine army, trying to root and rout them out, killing thousands of them. And then he comes before Saul, head literally in hand. It says so in verse 57, "And so when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. And Saul said to him, 'Whose son are you, young man?' And David answered, 'I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite.'" David showed immense amount of trust and faith in the Lord that day, seeming to be the only man in that entire battlefield who could be called a righteous man, who stood for the Lord that day, stood triumphant in the Lord that day. He should have been on a spiritual high like none other. I think he was. He sure did, so that the people at least rose him up before the Lord and before Saul, singing that disastrously wonderful song, "Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. But just as quickly as the people lifted him up, Saul tears him back down and becomes frightened and fearful of David. That, "Who is this young man who's going to come and steal my kingdom from me?" So I'm going to read this psalm again, Psalm chapter 12. And with that context, that picture in mind, listen again. "Help, Lord, for the godly man ceases to be, for the faithful disappear from among the sons of men. They speak falsehood to one another, with flattering lips, and with a double heart they speak. May the Lord cut off all flattering lips, the tongue that speaks great things, who have said, 'With our tongue we will prevail. Our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us?' Because of the devastation of the afflicted, because of the groaning of the needy, now I will arise, says the Lord. I will set him in the safety for which he longs. The words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in a furnace on the earth, refined seven times. You, O Lord, will keep them. You will preserve him from this generation forever. The wicked strut about on every side when vileness is exalted among the sons of men." David does not seem to be very high at this moment. In fact, verse 1, we see, "When whose words do I trust?" We see David, a righteous man, is in despairing words. He says, "Help, Lord, for the godless man ceases to be," or godly man ceases to be. David, who should have been way up high, so excited, instead feels about this big. So little, so small, because he feels alone. He feels so enveloped by the world's darkness and sadness because he has so many people coming at him from so many different angles. These are words devoid of hope. He begins with, "Help, Lord," or "deliver," saying, "Rescue me, save me, get me out of this situation. I don't want to be here. I don't like feeling this way. For the godly man ceases to be, for the faithful disappear from among the sons of men." As David is traveling along, he's receiving less and less help from his brethren and from those that have helped him in the past. He begins to hear the stories of their suffering. For example, in 1 Samuel 22, the priests of Nob's story, where they provide him bread for his travel. They give him armor and a weapon. They actually give him Goliath's sword to fight with, to have to protect himself. And in chapter 22, Saul finally catches back up to there and puts all the priests to death for helping out David, for helping him on his way. How brokenhearted he must have felt when David receives the words from one of the descendants saying, "My whole family is dead because we helped you. I'm not mad at you, David, but this is what happened." And spiral of darkness and sadness you see in verse 1. We see this same mindset occur in Elijah after the story on Mount Carmel, where he stands for God in front of the 400 plus prophets of Baal, proving to the nation of Israel that Jehovah is God, not this Baal. And yet what happens? Immediately we find him in the wilderness, afraid, cowering, because he's fearful of one rather intimidating woman. Or Isaiah or Jeremiah, you look through their books and you'll find instances of them feeling so alone, because they feel like, "I'm the only person left who's trying to reach out and save the nation." Even Paul felt this way at one point. Look over, if you will, at 1 Timothy chapter 1. 1 Timothy chapter 1. And we'll see even a man as mighty as Paul felt alone. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. He says, "But the goal of our instruction is love from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith." All of these are good things. All these are exactly what he's trying to get these people to understand. Verse 6, "For some men, straying from these things, have turned aside to fruitless discussion, wanting to be teached of the law, even though they do not understand either what they're saying or the matters about which they make confident assertions." He's saying, "I've taught these young men, these people, all these things. Now they begin to wander away in fruitlessness." And then you get over to 2 Timothy, it's gotten worse. 2 Timothy 1, verse 15, he says to him, "You are aware of the fact that all who are in Asia have turned away from me." It started out as some, and now it's become all. Even Paul has felt this level of aloneness, of the dark spiral kind of pit of sadness that comes from feeling like the only righteous person left. We can all feel this way from time to time, I think, especially when we go out into the world to our respective jobs. Sometimes it feels like I am all alone in my workplace. I'm all alone where I'm at. I'm the last bright shining candle in this vast pool of darkness. I'm alone. And we put our blinders on and we close our eyes because we just don't want to see and be a part of that darkness. But we need to be careful of this mindset. We be wary of this, because if we focus on that I am the last one standing, I am the last vigilant night, we're going to find ourselves quickly running into the wilderness, feeling like I can only trust in myself, relying on me to save myself. I'm all alone, forgetting about everybody, feeling forgotten by everybody, even God. But that's why when I was in the workplace, I felt so excited and encouraged to be able to go to church and worship on Wednesday nights. It was that spiritual recharge I needed in the middle of the week, because I came together after feeling 2 or 3 days of this aloneness. Lo and behold, there were hundreds, at the time of Camp Lord, hundreds, and now here, dozens of souls. It doesn't matter. Numbers don't matter. Hundreds there, dozens here. It does not matter. But there's still those people here that share the same thing as I do, that understand that I feel alone, but when we come together, I'm not alone anymore. We're together, shining brightly together. Or I'd spend other evenings with my brothers and sisters, that healthy reminder from God that I am not alone. I don't have to shine brightly by myself. There's so many to help me with that. We need to be wary of letting the darkness envelop us. Well, verses 2 through 4, we see the wicked man begin to speak. The wicked man has his chance with words, at his deceptive words. Look for a second at the words that the wicked man speaks in verse 2. David says, they speak falsehood or lies to one another with flattering lips and with double heart they speak. Lying to one another. For no man feels that they can trust anybody else. Because he knows, I'm a perpetual liar. And if I'm this way, what's to say that this man next to me is not going to behave this way? Or the other man in the merchants, in the market, is not going to behave this way? When I was in college, most of you know I was at FC. It's a private Christian college. So when I was getting my business degree from there, they said, the professor was very honest with us, said, you're going to be taken advantage of because you're a Christian. Because so many people in the world know and think, well, you have to act this way. I know you're going to act honorably, righteously, humbly, maturely. I know you're going to behave this way, so I'm going to take advantage of that. I'm going to do what I can to squeeze all the advantages out of this to your detriment. It's sad. Because when you go to work for somebody else like that, you see those practices begin to take place. Because they know, well, if the person I'm selling to is going to cheat me, why don't I cheat them back? And this becomes this perpetual problem. And it's sad because no man can trust. They say they deceive one another of double talk, two being two-faced. This reminds me of the Red Queen from Alice in Wonderland. If you haven't seen it, the Red Queen has a big bloated head. And all the rest of her court look to see, seemingly have some weird disfigurement like she does. Few of them have long pointed noses or large bulbous ears, or a couple people have large, extra large bouncy bellies. But when you get up close to really see them for who they are, you can see that the nose is just barely glued on. A quick knock and it pops right off. Or the ears, if you push, they'll just fall to the ground. When you look down at that man's belly, you see it's busting at the seams from how stuffed and full he is. Because they were being two-faced. They were trying to do what they could to deceive the queen so that they could preserve their lives by looking just as deformed as she did. Or they talk about flattering speech. We've talked about flattery before, of how it's not communication. It's just a tickling of the ears. It's to make somebody feel good without truly meaning what you're saying. I think of Bilbo and Smaug from The Hobbit when I hear flattering words. As Bilbo, before Smaug, begins to profess long lines of flattery, saying, oh, Smaug, the great and malicious hurricane of power, you giant snake, the calamity of our days. And Smaug finally stops and says, do you think your flattery will preserve your life any longer? And he stands and just goes, no, not at all. He knows. People know that flattery really means nothing. And it'll get you nowhere. It's just a nice tickling of the ears. And David says how fruitless this is in verse 3. May the Lord cut off all flattering lips, the tongue that speaks great things. He cries out with a rather severe punishment for those who have been mistreating, misleading him through his life, saying it would be better for you to not even have the tools of speech than to continue on in this way. It's pretty drastic. It's pretty radical of David to say these things. But this is how he feels at this moment, because he's been really abused by so many people. And they, the wicked, have sealed their own fate in verse 4. They, this is the wicked, who have said, with our tongue we will prevail. Our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us? They admit they know what they're doing. They know the tricks of their trade. They know that everyone else is just behaving just like them, so why should I be any different? In fact, they seem rather surprised and seem it strange that anyone else would not be acting this way. Why would you not make life easier for yourself Why would you not make life easier for yourself, David? Just do what we're doing. Appease Saul. Lie. Be flattering. Deceive him. Just follow along with us. It's so much easier. And when David continues to say, no, I won't, they say, who is Lord over us? Who is our master? David, who are you to tell us how to act? How dare you criticize our life choices and our practices of how we operate and do things? That sounds pretty familiar to our current culture, right? How dare you tell me how to live my life? How dare you try to import your morals, your values onto me? In fact, why don't you set all of that aside and then come to me? Come to me on my level. Then we can have a relationship. But I don't want to have anything to do with that. Compromise yourself and then come to me. Well, this is an interesting back and forth between the righteous man and the wicked man. But in verse 5, the Lord has interjects and says, enough. Bam. It's now my turn to speak. You asked, who is our master? Who is the Lord? Who is our Lord? He says, well, here am I. And pay attention. Because of the devastation of the afflicted, because of the groaning of the needy, now here am I. Now I will arise, says the Lord, and I will set him who has been crying out for desperate need, I'm going to put him into safety for which he's been longing for. Notice the Lord's answer here. It goes back to the beginning. He goes back to answer David's original question, his calling out. He says, you're asking for help. You're asking for deliverance. Well, it's coming. And it's coming swiftly. Now I will arise. The Lord promises deliverance here. And He's promised deliverance and gives it to those who desperately desire it. Elijah, at his lowest moment, what did the Lord tell him? There are 7,000 other souls who have not bowed their knee to Baal. To Paul, who is he writing to? He's writing to Timothy, his young protege, a man that he puts stock and faith in, knowing that while everyone else has left me and abandoned me, Timothy, you stand with me. You and I stand together. We are not alone. We're not alone in this. And David, if David would have just taken the blinders off, had opened his eyes in the darkness, he would have seen that there next to him stood Jonathan. Surrounding him was his mighty men of valor who were with him through this entire ordeal. Yet David kind of began to circle the drain a little bit in this darkness and in this understanding level of sadness. But look to what the Lord answers back to these people. He says, because of the devastation of the afflicted, some versions say to the violence that has been opposed or acted. Look at what the Lord is calling violence here. What violent things have been done? What did the wicked do? They speak falsehood. They're lying to one another. They're giving flattering lips, flattering words to one another. They are acting in deceitful ways, giving deceitful natures. The Lord is saying, this is violence. You are verbally abusing one another. The Lord sees that as violence. He treats this in the same regard as the Egyptians were treating the people in the time of slavery. It's almost the same language. He's saying, I hear you're crying out. I hear the groaning of the needy. And now I come to save you. I come to bring my people into a place that is safe. This should be a wake-up call to us. This should be a strong warning to each and every one of us that our words carry serious consequences, both good and bad, and that they should not be taken lightly, that we will have a record of everything we speak and say to one another. It'll be called up. How have you been speaking to one another? Are you been trusting in the deceptive words of the wicked man? because God has brought delivering words. And then he gives a promise in verse 6. David, reflecting on all this, says, "The words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in a furnace on the earth, refined seven times." So far, David has not been able to trust a single thing anybody has said to him, except for what the Lord tells him. Because he says, "Your words are pure. They are absolute. They are defining. They are reliable. They are consistent." He says, "Take heart. Because the Lord, when He says He will deliver you, it will happen." There's a hard level of trust there. But then David, though, gives this beautiful imagery of silver, of refining silver. Now, as many of you know, I really do enjoy the ancient crafting arts. Blacksmithing, ancient jewelry making, the making of precious materials, polishing gems and leather goods, things of that nature. But I had never really understood the process of refining silver. So I did a little research. And found out there's three important steps into refining silver. The first is this. Is that the silver needs to be held in the very center of the fire, where it's at its hottest, so that the impurities, the slag, will be burned away. When you melt the silver down, the slag will come to the top, so you can skim it off, get it out of there. And then you take it out of the fire, let it cool down, and then you do it again. And you continue to do that process until there's no more slag coming out of the silver. The second thing of that is that the silversmith, the man working with this, he needs to be present the entire time. He can't just put it in and walk away. He needs to sit there, watching patiently, carefully observing that the silver does not become too hot and become corrupted because it got so hot, it overheated and began to burn and melt away in and of itself, even in its molten status. But that says something else about the silversmith. That he is there also enduring the hottest bit of the fire, patiently watching and taking care of the silver. And the third most important step out of refining silver is this, is you know when the silver is pure and it's done. Because when you take it out and let it cool down, when you look at this beautiful piece of metal in your hands, you can see your reflection back at you. You see the image reflecting back out of the silver. That's when you know it is pure and refined. As silver tried in a furnace on the earth, refined seven times. That word seven times is important. It means perfect. Complete. This silver reflects back someone who's looking into it. The word of the Lord is like that perfect silver, finished silver. It is beautiful. It is majestic. It's special. It's precious. It's rare. It's very hard and tedious to make something this pure and special. So let's take that refining process and apply it to this psalm. David feels so lost and abandoned and alone in this corrupted world. The impurities are overwhelming and have really coated over that beautiful core that is his life and his faith. He feels like he's alone and dark. And now he feels like he's in the heat of the fire. Everyone is coming at him. He feels alone. He feels Saul breathing down his neck. Nobody's there to support him. He's in the middle of the fire in the heat. And if you read through the stories, you begin to see that the impurities begin to wear off. They're burning off. We know from history, from his stories, that this process was very needed for David. For David to become king of the nation. The king that the nation needed. That he needed to go through this so he could help Be ready to lead the people back to God. Those impurities in his life, arrogance, pride, naivety, how to deal with angry individuals, all these things, they needed to be burned out. Lessons taught to him so that he could be what God needed to be. David needed to see and be aware of what the wicked were capable and able to do. And to feel the burning away of all these impurities. To say, I'm not going to be like that. I'm going to be righteous and stand firm. So what does the Lord see in him doing? He sees, because of the devastation of the afflicted, because of the groaning of the needy, I will set him in safety that he longs for. It's coming. God the silversmith is watching and knows when it's too much for David and will remove him from the fire and take care of him. Because what happens after that process is done? What is said of David after this process of constant refining, of heating up, getting the impurities gone? What does the New Testament say about David? He was a man after God's own heart. That when God took David out of the fire and looked at him, God saw his reflection back. He saw a man after his own heart who shared in his image, who was trying and striving to be like him. He saw the beautiful core that was David, refined and beautiful and perfect. And David acknowledges that in the final two verses. And he went through a strong process like this. That you, O Lord, will keep them. That you will preserve him from this generation forever. You refine me, and I am where I need to be. So we have some quick application points for tonight. Out of these three things, and whose words do I trust? I think it's easy to say that we trust in the Lord's words. Trust in the Lord's words. Go back to verse 1. Do not let the dark overwhelm you. When it gets to the deepest point, the saddest point in our lives where we feel like darkness is enveloping us, taking us over, take the blinders off. Open your eyes because you will see you are not the only light burning. Don't let the darkness overwhelm us. And secondly, be wary. Be wary of the world's tongue. The wicked of the world, they don't care about you. They care about them. They care about their master, whether they acknowledge it or not. They care about serving him. Saying what they need to say, saying what they know will get them ahead in life. They're not looking out for us. Be wary of them. Do not let their words bog us down and tear us down. Don't let the darkness overwhelm. Be aware of their words. But most importantly, dwell on the Word. Dwell on His Word because it's perfect, because it's pure, because His words will save us. Because His words are what we need to get out of the darkness, to not let it overwhelm us, to put up shields and hedges from the world's words and their tongues. Dwell on it. Let it refine you. Trust in the Lord's words. Let us take heart, as David finally did at the very end of the psalm. The wicked seemed everywhere. The wicked strutted about on every side. When violence is exalted among the sons of men. But you, O Lord, will continually protect and shelter those who call out and seek you. Remember, while the fire is at its hottest, He is watching and knows exactly when to pull us out. And that once all of the impurities have been burned away, what remains in His hands is a beautiful piece of His creation that's reflecting His image back at Him. And we don't let the darkness overwhelm us. when we're weary and be aware of what the world's saying to us, when we dwell on His Word, the beauty will shine back at Him. And He'll take that and put it into His collection of things that makes Him happy. His children, His creation is shining back at Him. So if you're ready tonight, if you're ready tonight to be refined and to shine back on Him, we offer this chance now as we stand and as we sing.